How many of you have seen the movie Field of Dreams? One of the greatest sports movies ever been made. If you haven't seen it, there is a farmer, Ray Kinsella, who has a vision to build a baseball field in the middle of his cornfield. And when he builds this, all these great baseball players from history, including his father, they come wandering in from the stalks of corn. And there's this one scene where his dad asks him, "Is this heaven?" And the farmer replies, "No, this is Iowa." Now, I've lived in Iowa, and I can guarantee you nobody's ever going to confuse Iowa with heaven. You cannot trust Hollywood on these things. But do you remember the catchphrase from that movie? The mantra that drove Kevin Costner's farmer to build his baseball field. If you build it, they will come. And that has been the philosophy of the church, the evangelistic approach of the church for many years. We believe that if we built it, they would come. If we build the right building, and we build it in the right location, and we build the right services with the right music and the right preaching, with the right programs and the right ministries, that people would come to our churches. We would build it and we would say, "Hey, come, see, come check it out." And they would come and they would thus be attracted to the church and to Christ and the gospel. And we made building it into a science. And consultants could tell you how to design your facilities. And church growth experts would tell you how to structure your services. And we had conferences and conventions to help us build it better. And we did all of this so that they would come. We would build the right church. And we would invite people to come and see. And they'd want to be a part of it. And there's nothing wrong with the come and see approach in and of itself. Philip, one of the disciples of Jesus, used this approach with Nathanael in John chapter 1. Check this out. Philip found Nathanael and told him, "We have found the one Moses wrote about in the law, about whom the prophets also wrote, Jesus of Nazareth, the son of Joseph." "Nazareth? Can anything good come from there?" Nathanael asked. Now let me translate this for you. "Can anything good come from that backwoods, one stoplight, hit town?" And listen to what Philip says. "Come and see. Come check it out. Come see for yourself." The Apostle Paul understood that the local church could have this kind of impact when people came. That if they liked what they saw, that they might stay. In 1 Corinthians 14, he talked about what the church should do when the whole church comes together. And when they use their spiritual gifts and they speak and they sing and they instruct, he says that they need to do things in such a way that if an outsider, if a non-Christian person came among them, that it would make sense to them. They could understand it. They would get something out of it. And so he says, do this in such a way that an outsider can understand and thus be convinced and convicted by the truth. And then in verse 40, he ties all of this up by saying everything should be done in a fitting and orderly way. So Paul's philosophy wasn't so much build it so that they will come, but it was build it in such a way so that when they do come, they understand. And for decades, this come and see approach to ministry has been an effective strategy. Think of what we've seen over the last 30 years in the church. We've seen the advent of the mega church. I mean, it used to be 40 years ago, a church of 300, 400, 500 was a big church. But now we've got churches of 5,000, 10,000, 20,000 and more. We've seen the dawn of the multi-campus church, where there might be dozens of campuses. And they're not watching a live preacher, they're watching the video. I've wondered how that might work out for me. I could just videotape the sermon, put it on the screen, and I could sleep in on Sunday morning. What do you think? You think that would fly? But that does bring to mind something else that technology's brought us. The advent of the streaming of services and podcasts. You can watch a church service while still lying in your bed in your underwear. You don't have to get up. And increasingly, I'll talk to people and they find out that I'm a preacher. And so they'll talk about different church things. And I'll ask them, I'll say, well, what church do you go to or what church are you a part of? And they'll tell me things like, we watch so-and-so's podcast. Or we're going through the such-and-such series that iChurch puts out. And in their mind, that counts as being a part of a church, even though there's no community, there's no commitment, there's no engagement other than tapping a screen. But the mega churches were going to lead us as the church into the future. We would follow their example, and they are the ones that were writing the books and doing the conferences and the conventions. And we looked to Willow Creek Community Church up in Chicago, and we learned how to be seeker sensitive. And we looked to Saddleback Church in California and Rick Warren, and we learned how to be purpose driven. And we looked to these mega churches and we tried to build it. But have they come? Now, don't get me wrong. I'm not an anti-mega church guy. I deeply appreciate what those churches have done. My ministry has benefited from them. I have benefited from them. They've done a lot of great things and continue to do so. But the numbers are in and they're not encouraging. We have to face up to a reality. We are not reaching our culture for Christ. We've lost our culture. And the mega churches, with a few remarkable exceptions, have succeeded not in reaching the lost, but in attracting the already churched. They haven't gone out and found the lost lambs. They have moved the sheep from one pasture to another. And for 20 years now, people have been leaving smaller churches with less and going to bigger churches with more. And while the mega churches seem to be thriving, that success has not translated to the church as a whole. Overall church attendance in our country has declined. And every year, depending on the study and how they measure the results, between 1 and 2 million, I've seen as high as 2.5 million people leave the church. Thousands of pastors quit the ministry every year. And every year, more than 4,000 churches close their doors. And until just recently, the last year or two, there haven't been enough new church plants to replace the ones that have closed their doors. So we've built it, but they haven't come. And here is the reality. We are witnessing in our culture the collapse of the church culture. Reggie McNeil, he is in leadership development with the Southern Baptists, written a lot of books on this subject. He says, the current church culture in North America is on life support. It is living off of the work, money, and energy of previous generations from a previous world order. And Reggie's not a lone voice. George Barna, he's sort of like the George Gallup in the Christian world, does a lot of polling and research. And Barna says, emphatically, it is the end of the church as we know it. And he's got a whole book of data to back it up. And these Christian leaders are merely echoing what many in the world have been saying for a long time. Yale University professor of religious studies Louis Dupree says, the West appears to have said its farewell to a Christian culture. Christianity has become a historical factor subservient to a secular culture rather than functioning as the creative power it once was. So what he's saying there is that the church has become a subculture and it's no longer the driving force of the culture. But what makes these guys say such dire things about the church? What do they mean that the church is on life support or it's the end of the church as we know it? or that the church has just become a historical factor. Well, they say this for two very significant reasons. Number one, the church doesn't impact popular culture. The collapse of the church culture means that the church no longer has a meaningful influence on our culture as a whole. Instead, the church exists in its own little bubble, and it does its thing while our culture does its own thing, and we have very little influence on the culture. Whatever happens in our bubble doesn't affect what happens out here. The church has become a non-factor. It's not even a blip on most people's radar screens. Now, this is a fairly new development. Our society was once defined by the presence of the church, and even though many people weren't committed followers of Christ, our culture's morals and norms of behavior were largely influenced by a biblical worldview and Christian values. We now live in a culture, though, where the actions and beliefs and influence of the church don't even register on the cultural Richter scale. George Barna, the researcher, again, he did a study to find out which factors influence people's lives the most. And he gauged things like the news media, politics, family, friends, entertainment, celebrities. And what he found was that in the average American's life, the church is one of the least influential factors. It didn't even rank in the top dozen. Now, when I first entered the ministry, my first church was in rural Kansas. And even then, it was like a time capsule from another age. Local pastors were still invited to speak in the public school. While I was there, I spoke at a Christmas convocation and a high school graduation. And I quoted scripture. I prayed in the name of Jesus. Nobody batted an eyelash. Nobody said a word. Teachers didn't assign homework on Wednesday nights because it was a church night. Practice always let out early on Wednesday. On Sunday morning, everything was closed. The gas station opened at noon. But everything else was closed. There was a day and an age in our country where the church was the center of the community. The church would be one of the first buildings built in town. It was at the center of town. It was the school. It was the community center. It was the town meeting hall. And the community calendar was all structured around the church. There were blue laws. Stores and businesses were closed on Sunday. People didn't work on Sunday. Kids never had soccer or baseball games on Sunday or Wednesdays. And in those days, everyone knew what it meant if you called somebody a Pharisee or a Judas because they understood the biblical background. If somebody used an expression like going the extra mile, they knew the biblical background to that expression. Because our culture was informed by a biblical worldview. But those days are gone. And they're not coming back. The community and the school aren't going to plan their activities around the church calendar. Instead, we have the opposite problem now. You know, when Kelly and Sarah and I are talking about things and we're trying to plan events, we've got to think about, well, what's on the school calendar? What's on the community calendar? What other things are out there that we have to plan around? Kids have games on Sundays. We see the kids, they come, they're already dressed up, ready for their game. People work on Sundays, stores are open and have big sales. When I type my sermons, I have a problem with my spell checker. Because a lot of words that we use in church and a lot of words that are common in Scripture, Microsoft doesn't know they exist. And so it's always wanting to correct my spelling. When Jane Austen's novels, Pride and Prejudice and Sense and Sensibility, were made into movies in recent years, they had to filter out much of her original biblical vocabulary because the American audience no longer understood what those words meant. A few years ago, I had some Christian friends that attended the NCAA basketball tournament. And they're sitting there, and under the basket was the ubiquitous guy with the orange hair. And he was holding the sign, and you all know what the sign said, right? John 3:16. Of course, anytime somebody was shooting free throws, there he was. But what my friends found interesting was there were two couples behind them that were debating what the sign meant. One of them thought it was an advertisement for a new restaurant. And the other thought it was a signal for someone to meet him at the John on the third floor, the 16th stall. Now, these are just random examples, and I could go on all day with them. But they illustrate that we live in a culture that's no longer influenced by the church. And to further underscore that reality, Christians and the church are like the one group now in the United States that it's acceptable to mock and to ridicule. Can't make fun of anybody else because that's prejudice, that's bias. But you can make fun of the church all day. Not only that, but Christians and churches are beginning to be routinely and systematically ostracized, pushed aside, have their civil rights violated. Teachers are fired for reading their Bibles at lunch in view of the kids. Judges are reprimanded for quoting the Bible in their decisions. Cities are fined for nativity displays. Displays of crosses and the Ten Commandments are being torn down. Now, this doesn't mean that people no longer have a spiritual interest. The vast majority of Americans still believe in God. They describe themselves as spiritual. They still pray, and Jesus remains remarkably popular. What's changed is people no longer believe that the church has the answers. They see the church as a dried up, irrelevant, dusty institution, and instead they are turning to other spiritual leaders like Deepak Chopra, Paulo Coelho, James Redfield, Rhonda Byrne, and Eckhart Tolle. And what we in the church need to realize is that it isn't going back to the way it was. And we have fooled ourselves into thinking that, well, if we just work harder, if we do church better, we can fight it, we can change it. And living where we do here in the buckle of the Bible Belt, we feel somewhat insulated from this. It's not like it is if we lived in New York or Seattle or parts of California. And we think, well, maybe it won't happen here. But we know how these cultural changes, they are going to happen here. They are happening here. It might take a little longer for it to get here. But it is coming. And no matter how hard we work, we're not going to undo it. We're not going back. We live in a different world. The collapse of the church culture is happening for another reason. And if you're keeping notes in your bulletins, my outline up here is a little bit different from what's in your bulletin because I made a couple changes, so don't freak out. It's me, not you. It's okay. But the second realization about the collapse of the church culture is this. The church subculture itself, our little bubble, is facing imminent collapse. The institutional church in America is built on ground that is quickly eroding, and many people who study this believe it's not a question of if, but when the whole thing comes crashing down. And here's what I mean by the church subculture. The church has built around itself its own little world. We have our own organizations and institutions and parachurch ministries. At the convention a couple of weeks ago, there's a whole convention hall with all of these booths from all of these different ministries and organizations that serve the church and work with the church and do things for the church. We have our own publishing companies with our own books and magazines. We have our own entertainment industry with our own musicians and entertainers and comedians. And I, just to illustrate some of the changes here, I was telling Kelly about, before we went to the convention, I said, yeah, the publishing companies are there and they have these huge displays where they have all of these books and all of these materials and curriculum, and you can go look at all this stuff. And how big were those displays, Kelly? Yeah. I mean, there was a time when I would go to the convention and Standard Publishing would have a display area almost as big as this room. And now it had two little display things, and all of our publishing companies have now been bought out by the big major secular publishers. It's disappearing. We have our own education system. With our own schools and colleges and universities, and of course all of this is glued together with a certain set of traditions and expectations. The church as a subculture is collapsing. And to pretend otherwise is to stick our heads in the sand. The old traditional denominations are losing members so fast that their extinction seems unavoidable. And in some cases that's probably a good thing. But even the newer, more vibrant denominations are struggling. The Southern Baptists, who for years were the fastest growing Christian group in the United States, they are now in a state of decline. And the last couple of big conventions they've had, that has been a major topic of discussion. What are we going to do about the decline? The independent Christian churches, of which we identify ourselves, have stagnated. According to the U.S. Religious Census, our churches grew by less than 1% over the previous decade. And it's happening for three reasons. Number one, the money's running out. 80% of all money that's given to churches, when every week churches pass the offering plate, 80% of all money that comes in comes from people 55 and older. And once the baby boomers retire and leave their careers and start living on a fixed retirement income, the money that's been running the church is going to be gone. Number two, church is running out of people. I want to share with you some statistics that they showed at the North American, and this is a breakdown of the percentage of Christ followers by generation. So bring up the next slide. The builder generation, this is the World War II generation, those born before 1946, 65% of them are Christ followers and they're committed and involved and active in church. And then when you go down to the next generation, it drops by about half, the baby boomers, those born between 46 and 64, 34% of them are Christ followers. Then you get down to my generation, Generation X, the baby busters from 65 to 1980. Drops by half again, 16% are Christ followers. Don't bring it up yet. But based on that pattern you see there, what would you expect for the next generation? Yeah, you'd expect it to drop by another half, right? 7, 8, 9%. All right, bring it up. 4%. It's gone over a cliff. And the bottom line is this. What we're doing isn't working. And the answer to reaching this age group over here, well, excluding you, Gene, you're the answer isn't more guitars and more lasers and more fog machines and more of what we've been doing, only better. One of the more compelling things I heard a couple weeks ago, Craig Rochelle, you may know that name. If you don't know that name, you probably know of his church, Life Church. One of the big mega multi-campus churches. Life Church, one of their ministries is the YouVersion Bible, which most of you probably have installed on your phone. And that church spends millions of dollars every year so that you can carry around the Bible in your pocket for free. Pretty cool ministry. But he's that guy. And he did a couple of leadership things. And one of the things he said that I thought was interesting was that if he was starting a church today, it would look nothing like Life Church. He said it wouldn't work, not for the long term. And then he said that the contemporary church is the new traditional. And what he meant by that is this. Back in the 80s and the early 90s, when you still had the traditional church hanging on with its organs and pianos and hymns and hymn books, and people were fighting to bring in drums and guitars and that sort of thing, and the old generation was fighting tooth and nail to hang on to what they had, and the younger whippersnappers like me were fighting tooth and nail to, no, we need to change. He's saying that this is now in the same position the pianos and organs and all of that was 30 years ago. And the question is whether or not we're going to be willing to change and adapt and to move into whatever is coming next. Dawson McAllister, one of the leading youth ministry experts, says that 90% of the kids that are active in our youth groups will drop out of church by their second year in college. And one-third of them will never come back. So we're running out of money, we're running out of people. Thirdly, we've run out of influence. And I've already talked about how the church no longer influences the culture, but what I mean here is this: the church no longer influences itself. Attending church has very little influence on how people live their daily lives. When they gauge behaviors and the way people make decisions and the types of decisions they make between churchgoers and non-churchgoers, there's very little measurable difference. People who attend church are statistically unrecognizable from the rest of the population as a whole. In other words, attending church has very little impact on our lives. We've lost our saltiness. We have hidden our light. That's why we have no impact in the world. So that's why we're looking at collapse. Now, I believe this is an honest and realistic appraisal of the church in North America. The question now is, what are we going to do about it? And next week, we're going to start looking at potential responses. There are two responses that I think are very dangerous and destructive for the church, but they're very tempting and appealing. We need to be careful of those. But there's also a biblical answer that I think will enable the church to reach out to the world with eternal life. And we'll begin looking at those next week. But as we wrap up this morning, I'm going to beg you, please do not hear what I'm not saying this morning. When I say that we are witnessing the collapse of the church culture, I am not talking about the death of the church. Jesus told the Apostle Peter in Matthew 16, verse 18, I will build my church, and all the powers of hell will not conquer it. In Hebrews 12, it describes a church. The church is a mountain that cannot be moved and a kingdom that cannot be shaken. Ephesians 1:23 tells us that the church is the fullness of Christ who fills everything and in every way. And Ephesians 3:10, it says that it is through the church that the manifold wisdom of God will be made known. And in verse 21, it says that God's glory will be in the church through all generations, including this one. 1 Timothy 3:15 says that we are the church of the living God and that the church is the pillar and foundation of the truth. That means we're the ones that hold the truth up and we support it so that it can be seen and heard. And I believe the Church of Jesus Christ will not fail. She will not fall. She will not falter. And she will fulfill all that God has called her to do. The death of the church culture doesn't mean the death of the church. In fact, it may very well mean a great resurgence and revival of the church like we've never seen before. We just need to be careful that we do not confuse the church culture, which is dying, and the church, the true church. You see, much of what we call church today isn't really church. It's just our own cultural traditions. And it didn't exist in the first century. If you were walking down the streets of Ephesus in AD 80, and you were talking to one of the first Christians, and you talked about church the way we talk about it today, all you would get would be like, huh? If you asked this early Christian, where is the church? What time is church? Which church do you attend? What ministries does your church have? Do you realize most of those questions would have been meaningless to that first century Christian? See, much, if not most, of what we call and think of as church is not really church at all. It's our own church culture, and it is this church culture which is collapsing, not the true church. And it has outlived its place and its purpose. And we need to be careful that we don't waste our energy and resources trying to save it. When Jesus hung on the cross, He never wanted the impact of His sacrifice to be reduced to an invitation for people to join and support an institution. So let's put our hearts into what Jesus put us here in the first place. To love God with all of our heart. To love Him with all of our soul, with all of our mind, and with all of our strength. And to love our neighbors as ourselves. That's it. Love God and love people. 100 years from now, the church will still be alive and well. It'll just look drastically different from what we're used to calling church now. And the question is, will we be a footnote in history, or will we be a bridge to the future? Yeah. That question has yet to be answered. And the answer is up to us. And let me just say, I have struggled with doing this series of sermons. It's been nagging me for a while now, and I'm like, I don't want to preach this. I don't want to preach this. The reason I don't want to preach it is because we don't want to hear it. It's not comfortable. It's not easy. I know that. But I think we also have a great opportunity. If we would be open and sensitive to where God's Spirit is leading and willing to follow that, we will be able to reach out to our community and impact lives for Christ. But if we just keep trying to do what churches have been trying to do for the last 20, 30 years, we'll be able to keep the wheel spinning for a while longer. But I don't think we're really going to be doing what God has called us to do in the Great Commission. And so, I mean, me as a pastor, our elders and board as a leadership, all of us as a congregation, need to decide, who do we want to be as a church? What do we want to be? Where do we want to go? And are we really open to what's happening in our culture and where God might be leading us? Please stand as we sing the song of invitation and commitment. And as we sing this song, if you need prayer, we're going to have some leaders back here to pray with you. Pastor Kelly will be through those doors. I'll be through those doors. Maybe there's a decision you need to make in your life today. Maybe the Holy Spirit's been tapping you on the shoulder, and today's the day. You need to make a decision and you need to respond.